From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The legal battles over abortion are back. This time, the fight isn't being waged in Washington, but in state capitals. North Dakota last week banned abortions beyond a fetus's first detectable heartbeat, maybe at 6 weeks. It banned even abortions for genetic defects, the toughest abortion restrictions in the nation, with more to come. A state constitutional amendment that would ban abortion even after rape or incest, now headed to the North Dakota ballot next year. Pro-abortion lawyers are almost chuckling at the new laws, saying they are so unconstitutional they'll never stand in court. But a raft of states are passing them, saying no in big new ways. This hour on Point, North Dakota and new state abortion laws throwing down the gauntlet on Roe v. Wade. You can join the conversation. Have you followed what's unfolding in North Dakota, Arizona, Kansas, Idaho, Texas, Alabama, and more? Where is this headed? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we'll go to Texas for the latest on the shooting of the Kaufman County District Attorney and his wife, the second Texas prosecutor shot dead in 2 months. Huge uproar over that in Texas. But first, joining me from Bismarck, North Dakota, from the State House, in fact, in the state's capital, is Betty Grandy. She is a representative in the North Dakota House. She was the sponsor of the so-called Heartbeat Bill, which became law in North Dakota last Tuesday. Betty Grandy, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom. How are you today?
I'm well. Tell us about the heartbeat law first, Betty. There are others here we'll ask about, but what does this one say?
Well, the heartbeat bill states very clearly and very simply that that a heartbeat establishes that we have a potential life, and at potential life, we are not in North Dakota going to end a potential life, and that's where we stand. It's a very simple bill.
So it says as soon as it's detectable by standard medical procedures, that you've got kinds of sonogram that can get that, at ultrasound that can get that at 6 weeks. Is that your expectation, that 6 weeks may be the limit?
I put no expectations on that, because this bill really comes about to us because of medical advancements and technology that have come about since the 73 decision and since the 90s decision. And with that technology shows us that we have the ability to look into the womb at the development of this child. And we want to know that when we have a child present there with that heartbeat, that we would not want to end its life.
We'll look at that. Of course, the 73 decision being Roe v. Wade itself. What about the other elements that the governor signed into law last week, Representative Grandy, on genetic defects and gender selection? What's the law of the state in North Dakota now?
Well, in North Dakota, what we have said is that we are not going to pick and choose the winners from inside the womb. And so we're not going to say that it's okay to look in the womb and decide it, you know, and it's a fairly late marker time in a pregnancy that you see that, whether it's a male or female, because this one deals with sex discrimination. We don't allow for sex discrimination anywhere, so why would we allow for it in the womb? And we have in research found that there is a great deal of children that when diagnosed to have Down syndrome and other genetic defects that are being aborted at above a 90% rate. And I just feel that we don't allow for discrimination outside the womb. Why are we discriminating inside the womb?
Is there, under the new law then, Representative Grandy, is there any genetic defect or disfigurement that would make abortion, that would be legally aborted, or that fetus would be aborted under the new law, or no matter what is coming to term in the mother's womb, it's required to come to term?
Well, we are not going to, you know, that is something that'll probably come up through discussion, but it's not spelled out in the bill itself. What we said is that we're just not going to discriminate in the womb. If there is a point of non-viability, then we will have that looked at, and that will be between the physician and the mother. Again, we look at the fact that the heartbeat, well, if there is a defect that's not dealing with the heartbeat, then we know that if the heartbeat's not present or functioning, then that is not there. I'm not a medical expert. I can't get into all the different caveats of that, but I do know that we are doing surgeries basically inside the womb. I mean, we have a child that's in the womb, opened up, removed from the womb, still attached to the mother, operated on, put back in the womb. And so we are having such wonderful advancements, especially in the realm of spina bifida and various other so-called genetic defects, that we really need to be cautious as to what we're doing in our society. Going into the womb and deciding who's going to be happy later in life, who's going to be viable, who's a productive member of our society from inside the womb with never giving them a chance to take the first breath, I think is a sad scenario for a society that thinks that they should be making those decisions.
Betty Grindy, please stand by in Bismarck, North Dakota. We've got lots of questions about this, and we will discuss it in full. We're glad to have you with us. With us right now from Fargo, North Dakota, is Tammy Krominacher. She's director of the Red River Women's Clinic in Fargo. It's the only clinic remaining in the state that performs abortions. She testified in the Legislative Assembly against the new abortion laws. Tammy, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
So, first on the heartbeat law here, what will that mean for abortions in North Dakota, that they are not supposed to take place after a detectable heartbeat?
Well, what this does is sets the earliest stage that any state has set at this point and beyond the point that the Supreme Court has allowed states to go that far. The Supreme Court has said you cannot ban abortions prior to viability.
And by which they mean viability outside the womb, which has been seen as, what, 24 weeks or so,
yes,
generally?
Mm-hmm. Yes, about 24 weeks. Basically, you know, 92% of all abortions are performed in the first trimester, so most abortions are performed quite early. At this point, though, at 6 weeks, many women don't even know that they're pregnant because 6 weeks gestation is actually 4 weeks from conception. And so it's extremely early, and most women don't even know. And there's no exceptions for rape or incest in this bill. Abortion is a very contentious issue. I don't think that we're ever going to have a societal agreement on it. However, this bill goes too far in that it does not allow women to have an opportunity to think about their options, to think about abortion, to think about adoption, to think about parenting.
Let me ask about the work that you do on the genetic defect front here. What will that mean for abortions in North Dakota, that they are not allowed to end the gestation of a fetus with a genetic defect?
Well, and also genetic defect or sex selection. First of all, this is not a problem in North Dakota. I have never had a woman present at our clinic and say that she's terminating her pregnancy because it's a male or a female fetus. That just doesn't happen, and we heard that in testimony at the legislature that this is a problem in India and China.
So that's the gender selection side. All right, but what about the genetic defect side?
Genetic defect side, we actually only go to 16 weeks at our clinic, and so we generally don't see women. Those genetic defects are generally found later in a pregnancy and later found in very much wanted pregnancies. You know, I know somebody who had a very wanted pregnancy and found out that she was diagnosed, the fetus was diagnosed with trisomy 18, which is basically fatal. And she made the extremely difficult decision to terminate that pregnancy because she did not want to continue to carry a pregnancy that she knew the child would die when it was born.
But under this law in North Dakota, apart from your practice, which is a matter of your own choice, I guess, Down syndrome or some disease that would almost certainly lead to the child's eventual death or even severe disfigurement, none of these would be grounds for abortion?
Correct. Yes, and, you know, I think that some of the statistics that were brought forth, even the legislators who were hearing in that committee thought that those statistics were a little bit off. You know, and the other thing is what we're not talking about yet because it's not passed is Representative Grandy has brought forth an amendment on the one bill that's still remaining in North Dakota, SB 2368, that would ban abortions after 20 weeks due to so-called fetal pain. That would basically put a gag order on physicians, hospitals, that if they did diagnose a fetal anomaly or a genetic defect that was not compatible with life, those women would be those physicians would be unable to tell their patients why they were sending them maybe to Minneapolis or to another clinic because they could not refer for an abortion. They're just sending their patients off, and it essentially is a gag order on those physicians being able to talk with their patients about these decisions. And I find it ironic that Representative Grandy talks about a woman and her doctor will discuss that. All of these bills are getting in between the doctor-patient relationship.
You're the last clinic doing abortions in North Dakota. There's also legislation here that goes to what's required of doctors performing abortions. They have to have admitting privileges at a local hospital. Can you meet that requirement? Might this legislation close you down? You're the last clinic.
Well, you know, you can look at Mississippi, which has led the way on the admitting privileges bill. The very qualified physicians there attempted to get privileges at the local hospitals. Local hospitals don't want to engage in this contentious issue. And one of the hospitals here says they don't perform abortions and they would never credential somebody who did. The other hospital states that you need at least 10 patients admitted a year to meet basic admitting privileges. We've admitted one patient in 10 years. Abortion is extremely safe, and we would never be able to meet that requirement. I would never have a physician working at this clinic that admitted 10 abortion patients a year. It's unacceptable.
Do you think you'll be open and operating a year from now?
I do. I think that, first of all, the heartbeat bill is so extremely unconstitutional. Even anti-choice lawyers don't think that it will stand up to the constitutional test. And I believe that we have the Constitution on our side. And
we'll see if it goes to court, and it almost certainly will. Tammy Krummenacher, director of the Red River Women's Clinic in Fargo, North Dakota. Thank you for joining us, Tammy.
Thank you.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about North Dakota passing the toughest abortion restrictions in the country and the state-level push to go much, much tougher than the Supreme Court, throwing down the gauntlet to Roe v. Wade. Betty Grandy is with us from Bismarck, North Dakota. She sponsored the so-called heartbeat bill in the raft of legislation passed and signed by the governor last week in North Dakota. Betty, what about rape and incest? How does that come in here? You've got also up on the rails now. You're headed toward a ballot next year for a state constitutional amendment, as I understand it, for the so-called personhood measure, asserting the inalienable right to life of every human being at any stage of development. What would that mean for pregnancies that result from rape and incest, Betty?
Well, let's go back to these bills are about life. They're not about conception. And if we want to put in bills that dealt with the conception side of things, we could certainly do so. Those did not come forward this session, so that is not in there. There are very clear exceptions in the bills for the life and health of the mothers, and that is very important to us. And what has to be really clear here is that this is a state's rights issue, and the Supreme Court actually asked that the states look at these issues individually. That's why you're seeing it from all the different states, because the Supreme Court put it to the states to do this. On the gender selection, I do want to make a correction that was stated by Tammy, and that was that she referred to other countries doing this, but New York City is world renowned for gender selection and gender implant for children.
Long way from North Dakota, but you're saying you don't want to go there. But I just want to clarify, if I may, I understand these are about, as you put it, these are about life, but the legislature in North Dakota did approve the resolution that will put this constitutional amendment on the ballot, and if the personhood measure passes, just for absolute clarity here, would that permit abortion in the case of rape or incest, Betty Grandy?
As far as that language is, it is just simply states that life begins at conception.
So the answer is no.
I guess that would be no, unless somebody was to put something else in a law, but that is the constitutional.
That would be the North Dakota Constitution. Betty, please stand by in Bismarck. I want to go to Grand Forks, North Dakota right now, if I may. And Stephen Morrison teaches constitutional law, criminal procedure at the University of North Dakota, provided written testimony to the North Dakota Legislative Assembly about the constitutionality of the abortion bills that have just been passed. Stephen Morrison, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks.
So North Dakota has just taken a big step here, several steps, toughest profile in the country now when it comes to abortion. Many states are doing this, half dozen and more. What about the constitutionality of what's just been passed in your state, Stephen Morrison? Will it stand up? Should it stand up to Supreme Court scrutiny if it ends up there under Roe v. Wade?
As for the heartbeat bill, and as for the bill that prohibits abortions based on the gender of a fetus or embryo or any genetic abnormality, the answer is clearly no. Every single legal expert, pro-choice or pro-life, who has looked at this has said that unequivocally.
What is it about these bills that would not meet the test under the Supreme Court's current interpretations of Roe v. Wade?
They prohibit abortions well within the period of viability, prior to viability. And Roe v. Wade came out with a viability test that was upheld in Planned Parenthood v. Casey, that was held upheld in Gonzales v. Carhart, and every single abortion decision that has made it to the Supreme Court has reaffirmed that period of viability. Prior to viability, states can regulate abortions such that it's not an undue burden on a woman's constitutional right to obtain an abortion. These bills simply prohibit abortions prior to viability. That's one reason they're unconstitutional.
And viability, again, as interpreted by the Supreme Court, would mean outside the womb. If this fetus were outside the womb, would it be viable or not?
That's correct.
What about Betty Grandy saying, look, we've got medical advances, there can be intervention to save these lives much earlier than before. So she's sort of shifting the test and maybe thinking the court would too.
If medical advances made it such that viability could be placed at 20 weeks or 16 weeks or earlier, I believe that the court would find that that point is the point after which the states can regulate or can prohibit abortions, because it's not the 23 or 24 month period point, it's the viability point, and certainly medical procedures can change that, but there's no evidence that a fetus being born earlier than 20 or 21 months
weeks
is viable.
Weeks.
Weeks. Yeah.
Betty Grandy, in Bismarck, there have already been plenty of people saying they're going to come and challenge us in the courts, the Center for Reproductive Rights. I'm sure you must anticipate there will be a legal challenge to these new laws. How does North Dakota, how do you intend to respond?
Well, yeah, they have threatened their lawsuits, as they always do. I do want to have a clarification point. Stephen is speaking solely on his own behalf, not from the University of North Dakota, nor on behalf of the University Law School. Is this correct?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
What are you suggesting with that, Betty? Would you take funding away from the University of North Dakota if he were purporting to speak on their behalf?
No, but he had made those statements before, and I just wanted to be clear that everybody understood he was speaking on his own behalf.
As a constitutional lawyer, what will you do when and if, and almost certainly they will be challenged in court? What do you expect how North Dakota will respond?
Well, the same way we always have. Our attorney general has the duty to and will protect the laws passed by the legislature. Every law that is put into effect is constitutional until proven unconstitutional. So we can call it unconstitutional all we want, but it is constitutional until proven otherwise. Let's talk about the viability point. And, you know, typically the opposition doesn't like to talk about viability because they do abortions past viability. There's many cases actually and lawsuits going on at this time of women who have been killed doing abortions past viability. So let's not just pretend that there's some kind of an innocence on the other side.
Do you feel like you're breaking the law, Betty Grandy, by pushing this through the legislature when almost all legal scholars are saying this doesn't meet the Supreme Court test?
Absolutely not, because here's the thing. In 73, the Roe courts decided that viability was a compelling point, but the decision was based on the developed human knowledge of 1973. The knowledge of that time of what was in the womb did not reach and know was knowledgeable of what we know today. They did not prove a strong rational choice of point for choosing viability.
Yeah.
And most seem to think it has to do with the availability of what was going on outside the womb, because they didn't know how to look into the womb.
So you're saying it may be time to change that interpretation. Science has changed, and you're pushing that kind of decision. Some have said North Dakota's doing this now because you guys have become so rich on oil and gas money that you can afford a big legal battle. What about that?
Well, you know, that's all fine and good, and you can make those kind of comments, but that's all you're trying to do is go off point. The point is there's a heartbeat. North Dakota has been a pro-life state since before territorial days. We have voted even in 72 to when a referendum was put on the ballot to loosen the abortion restrictions in our state. It was turned down by almost 70% by the people. But here, the courts, you know, let's go back to the courts. You want to talk about it. The term was used for potential life throughout the entire opinion. If viability means the ability to survive outside the womb, of which they didn't state that case in the decisions, the womb, we are not that. You have to talk about the potential life. That's the words the courts use. The courts continue to use the term potential life.
I guess which has been interpreted as viability pretty widely. But we've got questions and callers for you, if I may, while I've got you. Craig in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. You're on the air with Betty Grandy and Stephen Morrison. Hi, Craig.
Hi, Tom. It's a matter of conscience. It's a matter of what the Declaration of Independence says. We're endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, life. It's a matter of the sanctity of life being determined in the 139th Psalm, verses 13 through 16.
What about North Dakota's laws? Are you for them, Craig, the new changes, the new restrictions?
Absolutely. It's a matter of the African-American race being targeted. 30% of their pregnancies are being aborted.
What about the Supreme Court decision that is being interpreted as saying so far that these don't pass muster?
Well, that's when you just look at Roe versus Wade, which has caused 50 million potential U.S. citizens to be aborted, and we wonder why we don't have enough workers, geniuses, you know, all types of people that we need. We've aborted quite a few of them.
Craig, we've got it. You're for it. Let's go to Joanne in Needham, Massachusetts.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I had a cousin who was 37. She was single, and she considered an abortion, but her family, she didn't have any children yet. Her family rallied around her, and now this little cousin of mine has been born, a wonderful little girl, and she's valued, loved, and cherished. And I think abortion is needed in some cases, but it degrades women as a whole to have abortion on demand. Thank you, Tom.
Thanks for your call. I'll get one more and take it to Betty. Tom in Buffalo, New York. Tom, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yep.
It seems to me this is nothing more than a frivolous lawsuit, not unlike a frivolous lawsuit to gain money just to go away. But in this case, it's a frivolous lawsuit to gain access to what would be deemed perhaps a more favorable court. Unfortunately, there's no penalty in this type of frivolous lawsuit. I would say if it does get to the Supreme Court and they do deem it to be frivolous, non-constitutional, there should be some penalty to pay.
Tom, let us pick it up. Stephen Morrison, you're the legal scholar. Frivolous lawsuit here or not?
I think the bills, the heartbeat bill and the gene and genetic bill, are clearly unconstitutional. So anybody who challenges these bills certainly won't be engaging in a frivolous lawsuit. What probably will happen is that the state of North Dakota is going to have to pay for the legal fees of any challenger, so that's essentially going to double the legal fees. If I could, I mean, I understand Representative Grande's position that abortion is murder, and I respect that. But what we're talking about here is a constitutional issue, not a moral issue. And we're forgetting or we're ignoring the fact that the Constitution has provided a freedom of a right to privacy, a freedom of bodily autonomy. And when it comes to the issue of morality and when potential life begins, I would just refer to a 1986 case, Thornburg versus American College of OBGYNs, in which Justice O'Connor stated that the difficulty with sort of focusing on potential life is that potential life is no less potential in the first weeks of pregnancy than it is at viability or afterward. What Justice O'Connor was getting at was that because the woman has a right to choose and a right to bodily autonomy, there is no easy solution, and so we settle on viability, and that's the point where a fetus's or an embryo's rights kick in, and that's the point at which the state has a right to prohibit abortions. And these laws go far, far beyond that.
Betty Grandy, of course, Sandra Day O'Connor's not on the high court anymore. You must be looking very carefully at its composition. If this is challenged and you respond and it goes up through the courts to the Supreme Court, do you think your chances are better today of having this stick than they might have been in 73 or in the 90s?
Well, absolutely, because we have moved far beyond what was utilized in those courts for their base, their knowledge area. The heartbeat does not say that the right to privacy is eliminated. What it simply says is that once a heartbeat is detected, the state's duty to protect the potential life becomes stronger than the right to privacy. When the court case was decided, the right to privacy was held in a higher standard. But they also turned around and said the states have a duty to look into these other sides. In the Casey courts, they said that if Roe is found to be wrong, it would be an issue of the weight given to the state's duty to protect the unborn life. North Dakota is saying that based on our current knowledge of life in the womb, the weight must be given to the potential life once the heartbeat is detected.
Betty, stand by right there if you would. Francis in West Palm Beach, Florida. You're on the air with Representative Betty Grandy in North Dakota. Francis.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I just wanted to find out if your guest and her compatriots are willing to pay for, you know, vote for legislators and pay for all the social services that are needed, that are going to be needed from the fallout from this legislation. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Francis. Betty, what about it? Are you also putting up more money for the kids who have genetic defects and other issues that emerge from the children who are born out of this? Does your concern extend to that realm?
Well, we have very good funding in place at this point, and we also had a piece of legislation that was killed by the opposition that would have increased the payments from the time the mother found out she was pregnant all the way through her pregnancy and into the early childhood time. The opposition happened to kill that bill. So they took away the funding. We didn't. We had that funding in. And absolutely. I mean, I happen to spend time and work on funding in those areas in my private life. So
we'll see how that unfolds.
One thing.
Yes, please, Stephen.
The point of the heartbeat appears nowhere in the abortion case law. And as late as 2007 in Gonzales v. Carhart, Justice Kennedy, who's the swing voter on the court, reaffirmed fetal viability as the point in time in which a state's rights to prohibit abortions kick in. And in 1973, the court knew when a heartbeat started to appear.
This
focus on the heartbeat, while I understand it, it's not a constitutional factor.
Does this look like a looming case that might well go to the Supreme Court, that might well cause a reconsideration of Roe v. Wade to you, Stephen Morrison?
I don't think the Supreme Court is going to take the heartbeat bill or the gene genetic case because they're obviously unconstitutional.
So does that mean you think someone else lower down would strike these laws down?
I think the district court, if it's filed in federal district court, and then the Eighth Circuit will both find both of these laws to be unconstitutional.
We're going to come back and look at the national picture. Stephen Morrison at the University of North Dakota and Betty Grandy in the North Dakota House. Thank you to you both for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about North Dakota passing the toughest abortion restrictions in the country and the state-level push around the country to go much, much tougher on abortion than the Supreme Court, throwing down the gauntlet to Roe v. Wade. In a few minutes, we're going to hear the latest on the latest killing in Texas of a district attorney. In this case, this time, and his wife. Second time in a couple of months this has happened there, and the whole state is in an uproar about it. Charmaine Yost joins us right now from Washington, D.C., president and CEO of Americans United for Life, the first national pro-life organization in the country. They wrote some model legislation for some of what North Dakota has just passed. Charmaine Yost, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on. It's good to be with you.
And with us from New Haven, Connecticut, is Emily Bazelon, senior editor at Slate. Emily, welcome back to On Point. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Charmaine, your group is pushing this at the state level around the country. What's the goal?
Well, it's important to continue testing the limits of how we can regulate abortion and to move our public policy into where the American people are. Currently, American public policy is in line with the four most radical countries in the entire world in terms of having the most permissive abortion policy. We stand with North Korea and Canada and have really, really much more radical public policy than people understand. So we're talking about just common sense kinds of solutions that match up with where people actually stand in America.
You say to where the public is, but I think we've seen polls still rather strong support for abortion rights. And as Betty Grandy was saying, in North Dakota, a very high percentage of people, for example, when it comes to Down syndrome, opt for abortion. Isn't that where the American people are when it really gets down to it?
Well, in actual fact, Tom, we've got people lining up who are willing to adopt children who have Down syndrome. There's not any shortage of homes at all. There's plenty of people who are very interested in providing homes for these children. I frankly was appalled at the idea that one of your callers would suggest and call the children who are born with genetic abnormalities as fallout. I mean, what does that say about a civilized culture that we can't welcome people who are not perfect in some way?
I think she was suggesting the overall circumstances that then emerge, where there are many additional costs and care issues that emerge. I don't think it was the children themselves, but the care for those children that she was inquiring about.
Well, and yet when we are thinking about other people who have disabilities or who are not perfect in some way, we don't consider taking care of them as fallout. We, as a compassionate human community, reach out to welcome them and make a home for them. And I think that in this 21st century, we're perfectly capable of doing that. And so this is just very common sense legislation that says that you can't kill a baby because it's a girl, or you can't kill a baby because it's not perfect. And I really think that the American people are very definitely with us on that. You're correct that we don't see overwhelming support for necessarily overturning Roe tomorrow. But when you look at common sense things like saying that if a baby's a girl, that we should welcome them, or a baby has some sort of genetic abnormality like a cleft palate or something that's perfectly fixable, that we should be able to cope with that.
Charmaine Yost, please stand by. Emily Bazelon, what do you see unfolding here? It is a remarkable number of states at this point passing some pretty tough legislation, North Dakota the most, but Arkansas, Idaho, Kansas, Texas, Arizona. I mean, look around the country. What do you see happening here? Do all these end up somehow decided in the Supreme Court and overturned, or are they surrounding the court, a court that may come out and be supportive of some or all of this? What do you see coming, Emily?
I think there are a few different things happening. One is a race among states with very conservative legislatures to be the first state without any abortion clinic. So you can see that
they're close already.
Right. There are states like South Dakota and North Dakota and Alabama and Mississippi that have one or two clinics, and the race is to shut those last places down. And I think it's important to point out that the implication is that women will have to travel great distances who live in these states. If the North Dakota clinic in Red River closes, there will be 800 miles from one abortion clinic to the next. And that's not a burden on women who can pay to travel. It's a burden on poor women who will still seek abortions, because that's happened when abortion is illegal or legal in this country and internationally. And so it's a question of how hard we're making their lives.
We had the University of North Dakota law school professor on saying that these just don't meet the tests of Roe v. Wade as interpreted to date by the court. But what about the implications for Roe v. Wade if and when this should come to the high court, Emily?
I don't think the Supreme Court will take one of these heartbeat cases or early abortion bans, because they won't have to. As the professor you had on mm-hmm. earlier said, under the scheme of Roe versus Wade, district courts and lower courts will strike these bans down. The cases that are the real test cases are slightly different. They're about banning abortion at 20 weeks or preventing doctors from performing abortions if they don't have admitting privileges. These other more nuanced ways of increasing the level of restriction.
In the meantime, what happens? These are pretty tough restrictions. They're on the books. This is the law in these states, and you know, until if and when it goes to some court that would turn it around, could they be on there for years? What do you expect, practically speaking, Emily?
I think there will be very fast court challenges, and very quickly judges will block these laws as being clearly being unconstitutional under the existing law. And the Supreme Court, Justice Kennedy in particular, the swing voter, has shown no appetite for allowing states to ban abortion at conception or at 6 weeks or at 12 weeks. And so I don't think we're going to see these laws going into effect. I think they are much more about politics than they are about creating law.
But they do go into effect, don't they? Or are they challenged before the rubber ever meets the road? You're saying they would never actually be effectuated in each of these states?
Most of them are challenged immediately, and they are immediately enjoined, which means the court issues an order saying that unless they're overturned by a higher court, they do not go into effect. That is usually what happens. So the Mississippi law, for example, banning doctors from doing abortions if they don't have admitting privileges at a local hospital, which no local hospital will give them the privileges, that law is tied up in the courts.
Hannah in Iowa City, Iowa. Hannah, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I would just like to, draw attention to the point that we elect officials to not be the priest and govern by what they believe, but what we think is best for everyone. And how do you, one, say that what you believe in is, what everyone should believe in? And also, as a side note, a caller called in earlier whether the state was willing to fund for issues now that the law is passed. And how do you, counteract that, especially when there are studies that show that because of Roe versus Wade, crime has decreased in the early 90s?
Hannah, thanks for your call. Well, Charmaine, there's Hannah saying, if you've got a religious view on this and you're a legislator, I guess she's saying, watch out from my view. It may not be the same as yours. And what about Emily saying, look, these are going to be enjoined. They won't actually even take effect. They'll be overturned. And this is a gigantic multi-state tempest in a teapot.
Well, let's take the question that I find the most interesting, which is what is the role of legislators in a representative democracy like our own? I mean, we have one of the most amazing systems of governance that the world has ever seen in terms of the length and the duration of our state-based federalist approach to governing people. And the idea from the founders that we've inherited is that it would be a representation of the American people. And I'm kind of inspired by the idea that in North Dakota, Betty Grandy representing the people of North Dakota, and after having had a very spirited public debate, was able to get legislation passed that is a landmark. And in the case of the genetic abnormality bill that we were involved in and that our attorneys help draft as a model, it's the first in the nation. And it's exciting to see the laboratories of democracy. This is exactly the way that states are supposed to function.
We've got just one minute. Where does it all go? You're orchestrating a lot of this. If it's going to be knocked down in the courts, even before the Supreme Court, what's the point?
Well, we work with pro-life state legislators all across the country, just like other organizations that hold competing viewpoints mm-hmm. do. And so over the last 2 years, we've seen almost 50 pieces of pro-life legislation passed that we were involved in. And there were many, many, many more.
Same question,
though.
If they're going to hit a wall of court rebuttal...
Well, it goes to the point of what do the American people want? And you see this tidal wave of pro-life legislation because Roe v. Wade is not settled law, and our law currently does not match up with how pro-life the American people actually are.
Emily Bazelon, what about that final assertion that our law doesn't match up with American public opinion?
I think this is about whether the Constitution protects basic rights for women in the face of dissension, deep dissension in the country about where we stand on abortion.
Well, a whole raft of laws now coming toward the courts. North Dakota, the latest and the toughest. Emily Bazelon with Slate, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Charmaine Yost at Americans United for Life, a president and CEO there. Charmaine, thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Tom.
In a moment, we go to Dallas, Texas, for the latest shooting of a Texas district attorney. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Kaufman County District Attorney Mike McClellan and his wife shot dead in their home some 20 miles east of Dallas. Maybe Friday. Their bodies discovered on Saturday. And this happening 2 months after his deputy was assassinated in broad daylight, headed into a courthouse. We're wondering what is happening in Texas. Joining us now from Dallas is Tanya Iser. She's a reporter for the Dallas Morning News. She's reported on this latest shooting. Tanya, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
What was the scene they found when they finally got into the McClellan's home?
Well, my understanding is that this was quite a horrible scene. Mrs. McClellan was found near the front door. She had been shot multiple times. Mr. McClellan was found further to the back of the house. And they think he was probably going for his gun, but did not actually make it to his gun. They believe that they used a high-powered, like, assault rifle-type weapon. And from what I understand from my law enforcement sources, they really do not currently have any solid suspects.
You quote law enforcement officials saying shell casings were everywhere. This is unprecedented. This is unbelievable. This is huge. And, of course, it comes just about 2 months after his deputy was shot and killed. Remind us who and where in that instance?
Yeah, what happened was on January 31st, Mark Hossie had parked his car in a parking lot where prosecutors and judges routinely parked. I mean, it was well known. And so he gets out of his car, he's walking to the courthouse, and he is gunned down with a handgun. So it's a different style of weapon. And, you know, witness accounts were pretty varied, so they really do not have a good description on the suspects in that case. And there were no shell casings recovered at the scene of that crime. And so prior to this most recent, you know, round incident, investigators had largely reached a dead end on the Hossie case. And most of my sources believe that the Hossie killing and this latest incident have to be related. I mean, they don't have any proof of that, but, I mean, how often have you seen two prosecutors killed in a county? And I've never seen it.
Pretty brazen to kill a prosecutor basically at the courthouse, and brazen again here at the very home of the district attorney. I mean, and shell casings everywhere. It sounds pretty bad. Was there sign of forcible entry, Tanya, or not?
You know, there were some initial reports that the door might have been kicked in, but then later on, my law enforcement sources said that they didn't believe that was the case. And as is often the situation in these things, is there's some of the initial information ends up being a little different. And, you know, what I'm getting from law enforcement officials is, quite frankly, everybody's in shock. I mean, actually, one thing that people keep saying to me is how shell-shocked people are. I mean, this is just unbelievable. I mean, the killing of Mark Hossie was shocking.
Yeah.
But this latest incident is unbelievable. It's the kind of thing that you hear happening in Mexico. You don't hear it happening in the United States. So this is obviously the FBI is involved, the Texas Rangers are involved, and I cannot imagine this is not going to be probably one of the biggest manhunts ever as they try to figure out who did this.
And it comes on the heels of the killing in Colorado of the head of prisons in Colorado at his own doorstep.
Right.
There was talk for a time of a potential connection between those things. You've written about this white supremacist 211 prison gang. What about that thread?
You know, the law enforcement sources will tell you they doubt that the killing of Tom Clements is related to these. You know, the 211 gang was a Colorado prison gang.
Mm-hmm.
There's been some talk that maybe the Aryan Brotherhood of Texas could have been involved in the Hossie case, but nobody really knows. But most of my sources kind of doubt that the Clements case is connected to these. But what is shocking about them is, you know, these are public officials being murdered, and it's pretty troubling stuff.
You've got a massive response underway there now. Is there, you know, do people have some kind of idea that maybe they don't have any proof yet, but they've got a suspicion? Are there theories that are going around that would explain this, or are they really in the dark?
There's a lot of theories. and a lot of speculation. You know, one of the theories, of course, is the Aryan Brotherhood of Texas. You know, there's theories about the cartels. There's theories that maybe this is some, you know, disgruntled defendant that they, you know, tried for something. But I think the scariest part of it is that they don't really have anything, right? I mean, that's the scary part, is that everybody's speculating and nobody really knows. And they are very hopeful that with having recovered shell casings from the McClellan's home, that maybe that will yield some evidence. Maybe there'll be fingerprints on them or something. They're extremely hopeful.
What's the mode of the district attorney's office now in Kaufman County? Are they hunkered down? Are they hiding out? I mean, they must feel vulnerable.
Well, absolutely. Because, you know, here's the thing. You don't know who, why they're doing it. So is there a list? You know, I mean, we don't know. And the district attorney's office is closed today. My understanding is that they have, you know, obviously put additional security on, you know, the people in that office. Now, how, you know, what that security is and how that's working, you know, of course they're not talking about that. But, you know, this is, you know, and how long that'll last, I don't know.
You say this is what you think of as happening in Mexico, but then who you know, is something cultural coming across the border, or if it's white supremacists, that sounds pretty homegrown.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, it's pretty troubling stuff, and they've got to figure out who did this.
Tanya Iser, staff writer with the Dallas Morning News, joining us from Dallas, Texas, on the latest killings in the prosecuting ranks in Texas. Tanya, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Tomorrow, we look at North Korea's war threats and American and South Korean response. Join us then. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.